The book of Jeremiah. For those of you who are visiting us, we are going through this prophet because we feel this is the most relevant part of God's word to our situation today. There are many parallels between our day and Jeremiah's. Chapter 10 through to verse 6 of chapter 12. Hear the word of the Lord, O Israel. Don't act like the people who make horoscopes and try to read their fate and future in the stars. Don't be frightened by predictions such as theirs, for it is all a pack of lies. Their ways are futile and foolish. They cut down a tree and carve an idol and decorate it with gold and silver and fasten it securely in place with hammer and nails so that it won't fall over. And there stands their God like a scarecrow in a garden of cucumbers. It cannot speak, and it must be carried, for it cannot walk. Don't be afraid of such a God, for it can neither harm nor help, nor do you any good. O Lord, there is no other God like you. For you are great, and your name is full of power. Who would not fear you, O King of nations? And that title belongs to you alone. Among all the wise men of the earth and in all the kingdoms of the world, there isn't anyone like you. The wisest of men who worship idols are altogether stupid and foolish. They bring beaten sheets of silver from Tarshish and gold from Uphaz and give them to skillful goldsmiths who make their idols. Then they clothe these gods in kingly purple robes that expert tailors have made. But the Lord is the only true God, the living God, the everlasting King. The whole earth shall tremble at his anger. The world shall hide before his displeasure. Say this to those who worship other gods. Your so-called gods who have not made the heavens and the earth shall vanish from the earth. But our God formed the earth by his power and wisdom. And by his intelligence he hung the stars in space and stretched out the heavens. It is his voice that echoes in the thunder of the storm clouds. He causes mist to rise upon the earth. He sends the lightning and brings the rain, and from his treasures he brings the wind. But foolish men without knowledge of God bow down before their idols. It is a shameful business that these men are in, for what they make are frauds. Gods without life or power in them, all are worthless, silly. They will be crushed when their makers perish. But the God of Jacob is not like these foolish idols. He is the creator of all. And Israel is his chosen nation. The Lord of hosts is his name. Pack your bags, he says. Get ready now to leave. The siege will soon begin, for suddenly I'll fling you from this land and pour great troubles down. At last you shall feel my wrath. Desperate is my wound. My grief is great. My sickness is incurable, but I must bear it. My home is gone. My children have been taken away, and I will never see them again. There is no one left to help me rebuild my home. The shepherds of my people have lost their senses. They no longer follow God nor ask his will. Therefore they perish and their flocks are scattered. Listen, hear the terrible sound of great armies coming from the north. The cities of Judah shall become dens of jackals. O Lord, I know it is not within the power of man to map his life and plan his course. So you correct me, Lord. But please be gentle. Don't do it in your anger, for I would die. Pour out your fury on the nations who don't obey the Lord, for they have destroyed Israel and made a wasteland of this entire country. Then the Lord spoke to Jeremiah once again and said, Remind the men of Judah and all the people of Jerusalem that I made a contract with their fathers, and cursed is the man who does not heed it. For I told them at the time I brought them out of slavery in Egypt that if they would obey me and do whatever I commanded them, then they and all their children would be mine, and I would be their God. And now, Israel, obey me, says the Lord, so that I can do for you the wonderful things I swore I would if you obeyed. I want to give you a land that flows with milk and honey, as it is today. Then I replied, So be it, Lord. Then the Lord said, Broadcast this message in Jerusalem's streets. Go from city to city throughout the land and say, Remember this agreement that your fathers made with God, and do all the things they promised him they would. For I solemnly said to your fathers when I brought them out of Egypt, and have kept on saying it over and over again until this day, obey my every command. But your fathers didn't do it. They wouldn't even listen. Each followed his own stubborn will and his proud heart. Because they refused to obey, I did to them all the evils stated in the contract. Again the Lord spoke to me and said, I have discovered a conspiracy against me among the men of Judah and Jerusalem. They have returned to the sins of their fathers, refusing to listen to me and worshipping idols. The agreement I made with their fathers is broken and cancelled. Therefore the Lord says, I'm going to bring calamity down upon them and they shall not escape. Though they cry for mercy, I will not listen to their pleas. Then they will pray to their idols and burn incense before them, but that cannot save them from the time of anguish and despair. Oh, my people, you have as many gods as there are cities, and your altars of shame, your altars to burn incense to Baal are along every street in Jerusalem. Therefore, Jeremiah, pray no longer for this people. Neither weep nor plead for them, for I will not listen to them. When they are finally desperate enough to beg me for help, what right do my beloved people have to come any more to my temple? For you have been unfaithful and worshipped other gods. Can promises and sacrifices now avert your doom and give you life and joy again? The Lord used to call you his green olive tree, beautiful to see and full of good fruit. But now he has sent the fury of your enemies to burn you up and leave you broken and charred. It is because of the wickedness of Israel and Judah in offering incense to Baal that the Lord of the armies of heaven who planted the tree has ordered it to be destroyed. Then the Lord told me about all their plans and showed me their evil plots. I had been as unsuspecting as a lamb or ox on the way to slaughter. I didn't know that they were planning to kill me. Let's destroy this man and all his messengers, they said. Let's kill him so that his name will be forever forgotten. Oh, Lord of heaven's armies, you are just. See the hearts and motives of these men. Repay them for all that they have planned. I look to you for justice. And the Lord replied, The men of the city of Anathoth shall be punished for planning to kill you. They will tell you not to prophesy in God's name on pain of death. And so their young men shall die in battle and their boys and girls shall starve. Not one of these plotters of Anathoth shall survive, for I will bring a great disaster upon them. Their time has come. O Lord, you always give me justice when I bring a case before you to decide. Now let me bring you this complaint. Why are the wicked so prosperous? Why are evil men so happy? You plant them, they take root, and their business grows, their profits multiply, and they are rich. They say thank God, but in their hearts they give no credit to you. But as for me, Lord, you know my heart. You know how much it longs for you. And I am poor, O Lord. Lord, drag them off like helpless sheep to the slaughter. Judge them, O God. How long must this land of yours put up with all their goings on? Even the grass of the field groans and weeps over their wicked deeds. The wild animals and birds have moved away, leaving the land deserted. Yet the people say, God won't bring judgment on us. We're perfectly safe. And the Lord replied to me, if racing with mere men, these men of Anathoth has wearied you, how will you race against horses, against the king, his court, and all the priests? If you stumble and fall on open ground, what will you do in Jordan's jungle? Even your own brothers, your own family, have turned against you. They have plotted to call for a mob to lynch you. Don't trust them, no matter how pleasantly they speak. Don't believe them. This morning we're going to be looking much more at the men than his message. It's going to be a rather different study to those we've had so far in Jeremiah. For he is one of those who was willing to let us see inside his own heart. And in that way to become vulnerable and to be misunderstood. For the reading I've just read to you is composed of four sections, quite distinct from each other. And they alternate. The first and the third sections were Jeremiah as a preacher in public. And the second and the fourth sections were Jeremiah in private praying. And there is such a contrast between Jeremiah in public and Jeremiah in private that we are going to have to ask a very big question. Was he a hypocrite? Was he an actor? Was he two-faced? In public, when he was preaching, he was dogmatic, very sure of himself. In private, when he prayed, he was full of doubts and very unsure of himself. In public, he was very forthright. In private, he was very fearful. In public, he was a tough man. In private, he was a very tender man. In public, he was victorious. But in private, he was vulnerable. Now, was he living a double life? Were these two Jeremiahs? How do they tie together? I think we shall understand this a little better if we put together sections 1 and 3 of our reading and study his public preaching and then study sections 2 and 4 together and look at his private praying and try and understand the man who lay behind the message. For as I've said, the contrast is so stark that people have raised this question about him. But when you get to know other preachers, you'll find that this same thing applies. And if you listen to their private prayers, you would get a very different impression from that gain from listening to public preaching. Why is there this duality? Can we understand it? Can we understand why a man is just so different? Well, let's look first then at the two public sermons which he preached in this section recorded for us in chapters 10 and 11. The theme of both public sermons is the same, Jehovah's sovereignty, the power, the glory, the might, the majesty of God in heaven, creator of the universe. That's his theme. But there's another theme comes through. This God who is the creator has made a contract, a covenant with a particular nation on earth. And it is because they have gone against this double relationship with God that the Jews, more than any other nation, have suffered so deeply. Other nations have denied the creator, but Israel denied the covenant God as well as the God who created them. There was a double relationship which they denied. The nations of the world deny a single relationship, But Israel denies the double relationship. And so Jeremiah preached two sermons on two different occasions. One on, you are denying God as creator when you make these idols. And the other sermon, you are denying the God who entered into a covenant with you, a marriage with you. You are his special people. And to deny your creator as a human being is one sin and a terrible thing to do. It's even worse to deny the creator who became your own special God and married himself to you in a covenant. Let's look first then at this denial of God as creator. Last Tuesday, midday, I was in the Royal Grammar School speaking to the boys there. And they were asking questions. I was trying to answer them. And the second question was intriguing. It was this: did God make man, or does man make God? That's a profound question. And my answer was both, both. God made man, but as soon as man rejects the God who made him, then he must make a God for himself. You see, there's what Huxley called a God-shaped blank in the human soul, and you've got to fill it, or you feel so empty and so hollow. And this God-shaped blank you can fill with many things. Everything that you try to fill it with is an idol in the biblical definition of idolatry. You see, when we think of this word idol, we tend to think of ugly little lumps of stone and wood. That's not the only idol that you can make. Your idol is anything that fills the God-shaped blank in your soul. We'll talk in a moment of the kind of idols that people use today to fill that blank. But the fact is, God made us so like himself that if we don't accept that and relate to him, we feel hollow, empty. Life is meaningless and purposeless, and we've got to fill it in with something. And so we make gods, and we make the gods that we like. Now, in those days, it was almost pathetic what they used to fill that blank. One of the things they used was astrology, horoscopes. Don't think that's very old-fashioned, do you? You know, this is nearly 3,000 years ago, and yet today, I've told you of that day I walked down the Champs-Élysées in Paris and saw a queue of well-dressed French men and women standing outside a shop in which there was an IBM computer with about four big banked boxes wired together, and the last one was a typewriter that could type a foolscap sheet in about that long. And French men and women were queuing up to pay £3, the equivalent of £3 sterling, for a horoscope for just 31 days. And the brilliance of modern technology was being used to promote this idolatry. And they were paying that because they were looking to that to fill the God-shaped blank. Now, I'm not boasting here, but I honestly do not know what sign of the zodiac I was born under. I just don't know, if you ask me. How many of you can say that? Put your hand up if you can say you don't know what sign of the zodiac you were born under. Right, put your hands down quickly. Or others will think you're proud too, but isn't that significant? 90% of you have had the curiosity to find out. 90% of you. And that's how it's permeated. 3,000 years ago, Jeremiah says, don't try to read your fate and future in the stars. Don't get interested in that. Don't be curious about it. He said, it's just a pack of lies. Don't be frightened by its predictions. They can't do you any harm. They can't do you any good. It's fraud. And yet there are more people in Britain who read their horoscopes than read their Bible every day. Many, many more. And so idols are not out of date, you see. It's a God-shaped blank. You've got to fill it with something. Now, at this point, Jeremiah has a scathing satire on idols. He particularly thinks of the wooden ones they made. He almost makes them laugh at it to see how silly it is. He says, you cut a tree down and then you try and dress it up so it doesn't look like a tree. And you have to nail it in place or else it might fall down. This is the God who's going to help you, you know, and you've got to nail him up there in case he falls over. And he's supposed to keep you up. And you dress him up and you have to carry him around because he can't walk. And this is the God who's supposed to be carrying you. And the fact is that whatever other thing you put in that God-shaped blank, whatever idol you look to see you through, That idol is something you will have to carry. It is not something that can carry you. Because you made it, and therefore it is less than yourself. Anything I make is less than I am. And therefore to look to something I've made to help me is ridiculous. It's illogical, it's unreasonable, and yet we do it. And a man builds up his business and he looks to that business to see him through. But he made the business. It's less than he is. And he's looking to this business as if it were greater than he is. And it isn't. Whether you make money or make love or make whatever, it's something you make. And therefore it's not something that can make you. Well, let's get back to what Jeremiah says. He has four contrasts between the idols of his day and the true God. And these are four questions we can ask about our modern idols too. First question, is your God weak or strong? Is your God weak or strong? An idol is weak. You have to nail it up. It can't walk. It doesn't breathe. It can't move. It can't talk. It can't communicate with you. It can't respond to you. It can't relate to you. It's weak. In fact, in a beautiful phrase, he says, your God stands there like a helpless scarecrow in a garden of cucumbers. Can you imagine anything more laughable than that? Than looking at a scarecrow in a garden of cucumbers and saying, this is my God. May I introduce you? Fall down and worship. Take your shoes off. Get down before. It's great. Scarecrow in a garden of cucumbers. What bitter irony, what satire. Jeremiah is laughing it out of court, but God is great. He is the King of the nations. That's his title. He's great. He's not weak, he's strong. Is your God weak or strong? You know, even the idol of churchianity, you will have to carry. It will not carry you. Religion, unless it's the religion of the living God, will always be something you carry. And as I've traveled around the world and looked at other religions and studied them, I've noticed that in every case people are having to carry their religion. It doesn't carry them, they have to carry it. It's one of the things that gives the whole show away. Even religion is an idol. Milmead can be an idol. It can be a great big lump of reinforced concrete that you look to for help. And I tell you, if you do, you'll have to carry it. It will not carry you. Only the living great God is strong enough to walk and to talk and to carry you and to be other than a scarecrow in a cucumber field. Second question, is your God dead or alive? That's a relevant question. Your God dead or alive? He has a young man and his God is his motorbike, and every Sunday he worships it and polishes it and bows down before it and does obeisance to it and looks at it and stands back and adores it. Is it dead or alive? It's dead. It's a lump of dead metal. And yet it can have the place in that young man's heart that only the Lord should have. He's filling the God-shaped blank with speed and power instead of with God. But it's a dead God. And you cut a tree down, says Jeremiah, and you may cover it with gold and silver, and you may get your best tailor to make a suit of clothes for it, but it's dead. It's dead. It doesn't breathe. And in that phrase, you've almost got the death of all idols. It doesn't breathe. It doesn't breathe. And so, as one commentator has said, when you lean your weary head against its breast, there is no heaving response. It's dead. But ours is the living God, before whom the world trembles. A God who's so alive that he can be angry. And when he's angry, you fear and you tremble. The whole world will tremble before our God because he's alive. He's not a dead thing up there. He's alive, and therefore he's responding to the situation. And he can respond with love and compassion. He can respond with anger. But he's alive, he's not dead. Question number three. Is your God perishable or enduring? How long will it last, says Jeremiah? And any God you've made for yourself will perish when you perish, or when the earth perishes, or even before you perish. But he says, your gods are perishable. And I care not what other thing or person a man puts in the God-shaped blank of his soul. What has been put there, if it is not God, will perish. One of the biggest questions you can ask yourself is this. This thing or this person to whom I've looked to whom my life is dedicated, this God of mine, will this God be with me after I die? After I die? Or will it perish when I do? Will it cease to help me when I do? When I go? Is your God perishable or enduring? Listen, God was always there. He flung the stars into space. He stretched the heavens like a great curtain. And he was always there, and he made everything that is. The question, who made God, is a nonsensical question. But I still get asked it. It's as silly as asking, can you make a square circle? Because the very word God, by implication, by definition, means the one who was always there before everything else was and who made it all. Which is the God of yours? Is it a God who's been made, or is it the God who makes? And you know, the funny thing is that if man will not accept the God who makes him, then he does make God. But this God always was there and always will be. He flung those stars into space. And now that we've seen pictures of the surface of Venus, doesn't it give you a sense of God has been looking at those rocks on the surface of Venus from the day he flung Venus into orbit? And we get so excited because we've got two photographs of two little patches that size. I'm not belittling the scientific achievement, but isn't it pathetic when you think of God looking at every part of Venus all the time because he shaped those rocks? He knows what the surface of every planet looks like. And so this is the God who doesn't perish. And final question, is your God worthless or precious, says Jeremiah. Our God is our inheritance, our portion, he says. How much is your God worth? The very word inheritance means that when I die, I get all of God. I've got so much to look forward to. He is my portion. He's my share. He's what I want. He's my inheritance. He's what I'm looking forward to. Oh, how precious he is. But your God, says Jeremiah, how worthless. How worthless. How much is your God worth? Do you know the meaning of the word worship? Originally, it had two more letters in it, T-H. And originally, the word was worthship, worthship. And to worthship is to give yourself to the person or thing that is worth most to you. That's what worthship is. And when we come to church on a Sunday morning, if anybody comes in and joins us, let us say to them clearly, we are here because God is worth more to us than anything or anyone else. And we're declaring his worthship. But now, what are your other gods worth? What are they really worth? I tell you, they'll all be devalued. They'll all come to nothing. The God of Israel is my portion and my inheritance. Well, now, let's come to those modern gods, those idols. Do you know, the extraordinary thing is that in Britain today, the cycle of sin is so reversing that in fact the very idols of Jeremiah's day are now appearing in Britain. I've mentioned astrology, and it's rife through our society. Britain's future is increasingly dependent on the Arabs. Who do the Arabs look to? Why, some of the most powerful Arab oil magnates in the Middle East read their horoscope every morning before they make a decision of the price of our petrol. Did you know that? So we're being trapped into a world that is governed economically by the stars. None of us can escape from that vortex of astrology, which is now influencing some of the most powerful men in the world, and through them, the entire economic situation. But there are other things too. The worship of Baal was deified sex. And the idols referred to were huge, ugly, phallic symbols. Exactly the sort of thing that appeared on the stage of the Even Arnold Theatre a few months ago. Not made of wood or stone, but of fiberglass. That shows you how modern we are. But a 9-foot-high phallic symbol was the scenery in the Even Arnold Theatre for a Shakespeare play. These are the very things. The name given to them in the Hebrew is not given today. It's the same thing. So we're not so modern as we thought. We're not so far removed from idolatry. We're not so far from Canaan. We're not so far from Jeremiah's situation. But Jeremiah says, your gods are as many as your cities. And the fact is that we have added many other gods. There are many other idols. A man may have as his idol his own family, and that may come absolutely first. He may go to church, he may worship God, but that's what's first. And his own family, he will do anything for his family. He will do anything to protect them. He will be hurt more if anything happens to them than anything else that could happen to him. That's his God. Another man, it's his house. You can tell just by looking at his house. That's what his God is. That's what he looks to provide him with peace and security and comfort and everything that he wants. That's his God. And another man, it's his car. You can see by looking at his car. Another man, it's his business. You can see by the way he reads the Financial Times. You can see that there are idols that fill this God-shaped blank, things that a man lives for and looks to see him through. It's very sad, because many of these things may be quite legitimate in their place, but it's never first place. And I remember Abraham, who was tempted to dote on his little boy because he'd got no children, only the one boy, really of his own, by Sarah, and he worshipped this little boy, and he just... This little boy could become his God so easily, so God said, take Isaac, whom you love, and kill him. When Abraham did that, God said, stop, stop. Now I know. He's not your God. He's number two. See, whatever is number one, and you see, it doesn't matter whether you go to church or not, isn't there something pretty devastating in this? Jeremiah says, these businessmen, they take root and their business grows. You plant them, their profits multiply and they are rich. They say thank God. That means they're in church on Sunday. They say thank God. But in their hearts, they give no credit to you. Do you notice that? In their hearts, they don't give you the credit. They don't say, God, I'm in church because I know that without you, my business would collapse. I know that without you, I could never have got where I've got. No, they say thank God, but in their heart, I'm pretty cute, you know. I've played the markets well. I've seen these things. It's my God. The dearest idol that I have known, whate'er that idol be, help me to tear it from thy throne. You sing it. Do you believe it? Do you mean it? You sing it. Well, that's a pretty strong, forthright sermon. Let's move quickly on to the second sermon. Jeremiah not only says you've copied other nations and gone after idols, you've filled the God-shaped blank with other than the living, true God, King of the nations, creator of the earth who flung the stars in space. But you Jews have done something even worse. It's bad enough for godless people to do this. It's bad enough for the nations of the world to behave this way. But what have you done? You have had a covenant with him. You've been married to God. You weren't just created by him, you were loved by him, and you were brought into a covenant. He's referring to Mount Sinai. And in chapter 11, verses 1 to 17, Jeremiah is recorded as saying four things, four steps. The first paragraph, you became disinterested in the covenant. You lost interest, you didn't pay heed. You just ignored it. Step number two, you became disobedient. Even when you knew and had told you what the covenant said, you didn't do it. Step number three, you became dissolute. And you ran after other gods and your moral standards went. Step number four, disowned. When you tried to get back to God, you found he wouldn't listen to you. Now that's a very simple four-point sermon. And I want to give it to you. In the form of an analogy, a covenant is a marriage. You know, when two young people come to be married, sometimes, not usually in a modern service, but one of the things they used to say when they put the ring on or when they made the promise, as a token of the vow and covenant made betwixt me and thee. Covenant, marriage. So let me trace those four steps in a marriage. Here they are. Step number one, when the wife stops paying attention to her husband, that's the first step of the breaking of the marriage. When she just doesn't pay him any attention. I'm using the this way round for the wife because Israel to Jehovah was a wife to her husband. And so step number one, the wife just stopped paying attention to the husband, just didn't listen. just didn't notice what his feelings were. Step number two, when the wife started living her own life, even though she was still under the same roof as her husband, when she went to this, to her bridge party, when he went out to that, living her own life, just not doing what he wanted her to do, not going out with him when he wanted to go out together, but just saying, no, I've planned this for tonight, living one's own life under the same roof. The marriage is still not broken, but there's a deeper stage of breaking being reached. Stage number three, when she finds another man more interesting than her own man and begins to play around with other men. At that point, the marriage has broken. Stage number four, she comes back reeking with perfume and says hello, darling, to the husband and is surprised that he's cool and that he doesn't want her back. Now that's Jeremiah's sermon, and he says, Israel, that's what you did to God. At first you just didn't pay him much attention, you didn't heed the covenant. Then you began to live your own life, you didn't obey the covenant. Then you went after other gods, and you know the intriguing thing is that the word Baal means my husband. So it's a very relevant illustration. Then comes the main point of this sermon, and it's devastating. Jeremiah says this, what right has my beloved in my house? Because when they felt the national emergency, when they needed God, they poured back into the temple to pray. And they came back with perfume from Sheba for God, and they offered sacrifices. And God says, what right has my beloved in my house? Now the bitterness of that comes through in the word beloved. You notice that? My beloved. She ignored me. She lived her own life. She went after other men. And now she comes back. What right has my beloved in my house? It's the agony of God's heart coming through in that. What right has she in my house when she's done this? And God looks at Israel and says, what right has she to come and into my temple? And he says, Jeremiah, don't weep for her. Don't pray for her. Don't plead for her. Don't make it worse for me than it is. My beloved comes running back with perfume and wants to love me. And look what she's been. What right has she to be in my house? It's a powerful sermon. And I draw from it this one lesson. That God feels even more keenly the agony of someone who has been his, who has had a godly background, who knows him, and who then drifts after other gods and then comes back as if they can just walk in and say, God, here I am again. I'm yours. You see, God judges by those, by the opportunities we have had. That's why he was more severe with Israel than any other nation. The other nations hadn't got the covenant. They simply rebelled against the Creator, but Israel rebelled against a covenant God. No wonder that Jesus said, woe unto you, Capernaum. Now, Capernaum is a beautiful little fishing village on the edge of the Sea of Galilee. It's beautiful. And you know, just 70 miles to the south is the Dead Sea. And in the bottom of that Dead Sea, somewhere under its waves, lies the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. And yet Jesus said, woe unto you, Capernaum. It'll be better for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for you. Why? Because you've had me in your town. Sodom never had. If the mighty works that had been done in you were done in Sodom and Gomorrah, they'd have repented. But you've had the bigger chance. And it's a sobering thought that those of us who've been brought up in a Christian country, who've heard the gospel, who've had it taught to us in day school, those of us who know the truth about God, will be dealt with much more hardly than the pygmies in Central Africa who never heard. Much more hardly. The covenant people are judged more severely than those who are simply the created people. Well, now, so much for Jeremiah's public ministry. It's powerful, it's forthright, it's strong. And yet when you go into his private prayer life, you find a very different Jeremiah. A Jeremiah full of questions and doubts and fears. And a Jeremiah who's hesitant, and a Jeremiah who's broken from time to time. For we have come in this section we read to the first of what have been called the Confessions of Jeremiah, in which he showed you how he felt inside about all this. Not nearly so sure of himself, his emotions torn in two between his people and his God. And from time to time he found himself on the side of his people and against his God. So feeling was he. And from one point of view, I hope that there are times when you feel the same. I hope there are times when your heart rebels against the fact that some of your physical relatives are going to be in hell. And I hope your heart takes their side against God sometimes, because that will show that you still have a heart. And God was patient with Jeremiah when he took the same line. Now, Jeremiah was torn in emotions by this fact. On the one hand, he had a deep empathy with his people. He loved them. He wept for them. He prayed for them. He felt for them. And on the other hand, he had such an estrangement from them that they plotted to kill him. And this was the tension. No human being likes this. To love people so much that you can't bear the thought of their being judged by God, and yet knowing that all the time they judge you. That's hard. And so Jeremiah reveals his heart. We consider first his empathy with his people. In chapter 10, verses 17 to 25, he feels keenly the disaster that's coming, the invasion that's coming. So keenly does he feel it that in the first person singular, he describes a situation that he will never have. He says, "My children are gone." Now, he was forbidden to marry. He never had children, because he never had a wife. But so deeply could he feel for his countrymen that he could almost feel the invasion already happening, and he could feel the moment when they picked up their bags to make the long trek to Babylon, when they said goodbye to their children for the last time, when they closed their front door knowing they'd never see their own home again, when they pulled their tent up knowing they would never pitch it again in their own land. He feels it. He says, "Desperate is my wound, my grief is great, my sickness is incurable. My home is gone, my children have been taken away, I will never see them again. There's no one left to help me rebuild my home." It pours out. He feels it so deeply that already he's living in the sorrow of it. And you know, a man can only preach in a dogmatic and forthright way and denounce people as strongly as he did in public if in private he feels as deeply as this for what they are to go through, if he can weep for them, and if he can really feel the horror of it. That's his empathy. And out of that empathy with his people comes a prayer. "Lord," he says, "I know I'm weak. I know it's not in a man to plan his life. I know it's not in us to live the life you want us to live. I know we're weak, but Lord, please don't be too angry with us. Don't blot us out altogether. Lord, couldn't you just have some of your anger for the nations that are attacking us? Lord, just don't be too angry with us, please. Don't blot us out. Don't wipe us out altogether." Comes at the end of chapter 10. "O Lord, I know it is not within the power of man to map his life and plan his course, so correct me, Lord, but please don't be angry with me or I'll die." He's feeling the judgment of God and pleading that it be not too severe. That's his empathy. And so he accepts that judgment is right. He says we must bear it. But somehow, you know, you get a picture of a people picking up their bundles to be taken away. When I read this phrase, my mind went back to a newsreel film of the Jews being loaded onto trains in Germany. Have you seen those newsreel films? Have you seen how they, past weeping, just picked up their little feeble bundles and got on the train, knowing they'd never see their families again, knowing they'd never see their homes again? But they went. I'm sure that in many of their hearts they were saying, "Lord, couldn't you just be angry with the people who are doing this to us?" And Jeremiah reveals his torn heart. "Lord, I know the judgment is correct. I know that we've not planned our course right. I know that you have a right to be angry. We must bear our punishment, but Lord, please don't make it too much. It's very human. A man who in public can say the judgment of God will wipe you out, in private says, Lord, please don't. Got the tension. Now, finally, let's look at his estrangement from his people. He felt so close to them, but they did not feel close to him. And it came to him as a frightful shock that the people of his own village, Anathoth, you can still see the little town, the Arab town of Anatah, about 3.5 miles northeast of Jerusalem, the people of his own village of Anatah, Anathoth, these people were actually plotting his death. He never realized it. He never dreamt that their looks, their dark looks at him, their whispers when he was around, he never dreamt that this is what they were doing until God told him one day, Jeremiah, they hate your guts. Jeremiah, they're going to kill you. Do you know that? Jeremiah realized that a man's foes shall be those of his own household. The incredible thing is the men of Anathoth says, let's kill Jeremiah and we'll blot out his name. We'll forget his name. He's let us down. We don't want one of our relatives speaking like this. So let's blot out his name. You know, isn't it incredible? The men of Anathoth, their only claim to fame is that they tried to kill Jeremiah. Isn't it incredible? But for Jeremiah, they would never be thought of. Never be spoken of. Here in the year 1975, I'm talking of the men of Anathoth. Why? Because Jeremiah is famous, that's why. Because Jeremiah's name is known throughout the world. It's been known by millions. This young boy is worldwide fame. And the men of Anathoth are only remembered because hasn't got a sense of humor. He sits in heaven and he laughs at such goings on. So Jeremiah says, God, deal with them, deal with them. I feel like a lamb before the slaughterer. Deal with them. And God says, it's all right, I will. Vengeance is mine. I will repay. You know, if you're suffering any persecution at all, and I know that some of you are, I know that some of you have friends who don't like you, I know that some of you have relatives who despise you, let me remind you, God will put that right. God will deal with them. In fact, if you realize that God will, it'll make you a little tenderer towards them. Do you realize that if anyone laughs at a Christian because he's a Christian, God will punish him for that? You don't need to worry. Jeremiah says, God, will you deal with them? God says, look, I have already decided to deal with them. Their sons and daughters will perish and starve. Don't you worry about that, Jeremiah. Leave your enemies to me. You get on with the job. So Jeremiah did. But he not only had to cope with fightings without, but he had to cope with fears within. The last thing we look at this morning is perhaps the deepest. Jeremiah was afflicted with intellectual doubts. Even while he preached without any trace of doubt whatever, he had deep doubts in his own mind. And the doubts were these. It's a very, very old problem. Lord, you tell me that the wicked will be punished, and look at them. They're making money. Their businesses prosper. They're fat. They're sleek. It doesn't tie up. Lord, the facts around me don't fit my faith. And this is one of the biggest questions that a man of God has to cope with. And it comes all the way through the Bible. You'll find it in Psalm 73. You'll find it right through the book of Job. What happens when the facts don't fit in with your faith? And Jeremiah did the right thing. He didn't preach about his doubts. Neither do I. And you'll never catch me preaching about my doubts from this pulpit. You have to come and listen to my prayers to get those. I love the true story of the lady who went to her minister and said, I wish you'd preach on some of your convictions. She said, I've got enough doubts of my own without coming to church to listen to yours. And too many preachers are airing their doubts in the pulpit. The person to take your doubts to are not the people, but God. And every man of God has moments when he's overcome with the fact that the facts and his faith don't fit. And he goes to God. As Jeremiah went to God, fightings without, Jeremiah coped with that. But fears within, he found that much more difficult. And he said, God, why? Why do the wicked prosper? Here I'm preaching this, and you just seem to leave them to get on and make money. They don't listen. They don't respond. They're comfortable. They're happy. They're secure. Why, God? I don't understand it. Why? You see, Jeremiah is being shaken by the facts of society. And he says, how long, God? How long? How long is this land to put up with this? How long are you going to delay your punishment? I've said you're going to punish them, but how long before you come and do it? They're just laughing at you because you're not doing anything. How long, Lord? Why? Why? And here's a man with terrific doubt, a man whose faith is tottering. I just thank God for an honest Bible, don't you? I thank God for a Bible that says men of the caliber of Jeremiah struggled with doubts in private and had to ask God why, how long. Do you know what God's answer was? God didn't answer any of his questions. He didn't clear up any of his doubts. God said, Jeremiah, I'm depending on you. If you're shaken already, how long will you keep going? That's my question. If you're shaken by infantry, what will happen when the cavalry come? If you're shaken fighting in an open field, what will happen when you find yourself in the jungle? In other words, Jeremiah, there's much worse to come. And I had hoped that the little battles you've had so far would prepare you for the bigger ones. Jeremiah, I want you to see that the battles you've got now are nothing compared with what's coming. Jeremiah, I'm depending on you. Jeremiah, how long will you keep going? Jeremiah's question was, why do they prosper? But God's question back was, how will you preach if you're shaken by these facts? Look, I told you what to say, Jeremiah. Don't be shaken by what you see. Believe in me and go on speaking. You've got bigger battles ahead. And I gave you these smaller battles so that you were ready for the bigger ones. Do you know, God is being both tough and tender. He's lifting Jeremiah up. He's boosting his morale. He's saying, Jeremiah, now stand on your feet. Be a man. Don't let these things shake you, because there's a bigger battle ahead. God doesn't always answer our doubts. You say, God, why? Why are you doing this? God doesn't always say. But he says, look, don't let it shake you. Don't let it shake you. Go on fighting. God says, Jeremiah, your own family are going to attack you. How will you cope with that? I know your villagers have. I know the men of Anathoth have. But Jeremiah, your own brothers and sisters are going to do it. How will you cope then? Oh, Jeremiah, pull yourself together. You shouldn't be asking me questions. I should be asking you questions. Do you know that's how Job was dealt with? Job brought his doubts to God, and Job said, God, why? Why am I suffering? Why are you letting these things happen to me? And you know how God answered those questions? He said, Job, were you there when the foundations of the earth were laid? Do you know where the snow comes from? Do you know where the wind comes from? Do you know how nature works? And he just battered poor old Job into the ground with questions, until Job got the answer to his questions. And do you know what the answer was? God thinks he is God. Which isn't very odd. That's the answer. It's got to be sorted out in prayer. When you're afflicted with doubts, you can go to a Christian and ask questions. They can try and answer them. The best thing you can do is to take your doubts to God and let God ask you questions. For God thinks he is God, which isn't very odd. And God is saying, Jeremiah, have I told you that I would answer all your questions? Do I have to tell you everything I know before you'll tell the truth that I ask you to pass on? Jeremiah, you'll have to trust me where you don't understand. I'm not going to answer your questions. I'm going to put you back in the battle, and a fiercer battle, a stronger battle. And you fight. So we've come to the answer to our question. Why is it that in private Jeremiah was so shaken, so unsure, so full of doubt, yet in public he preached so dogmatically, so strongly? Why in public could he say, God will punish you, and in private could he say, when are you going to, Lord, and why don't you get on with it? I'll tell you why. The answer is very simple. He's not a hypocrite. He's not an actor. He's not two-faced. The answer is, In public, the words of God were on his lips. In private, the words of men were on his lips. In public, he spoke from God to men. In private, he spoke from men to God. And if you think that's weakness, if you think that's a contradiction, let me take you to the very person whose death we remember this morning in broken bread and poured out wine. There is Jesus himself, the Son of God. In public, listen to his courage. In public, listen to him speak. Listen to him call the Pharisees whited sepulchres. Listen to him defy Herod and say, go and tell that fox. Listen to him say, no man takes my life from me. I lay it down of myself and I take it up again. Brave words, strong words, courageous words in public. But now come with me into private prayer, into a garden of Gethsemane, where with drops of blood on his brow, he says, Father, please, take this cup away. I can't cope with it. Please take it away. Nevertheless, not my will. And come with me later, just a few hours, on the cross. And here he is saying, why? 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 Private prayer again. My God, why have you forsaken me? And there's no answer from heaven, no answer at all. God doesn't answer. And even Jesus himself had this strange dual experience. In public, he spoke so strongly, gave the word of God to men. But in his private prayer, he's a man speaking to God, saying, God, why? Why? And so, we do not regard it as a sign of weakness that Jeremiah had this experience. And if you're to be a man or a woman of God, you must be bold in public. You must speak the truth, whatever it costs. But in private, you can take your questions to God. You can take your doubts to God. You can take the uncertainties, the torn emotions. You can admit to God, God, there are times when I feel if my relatives are not going to be in heaven, I don't want to be there either. You be honest with God. That's what Jeremiah was saying. And God will not answer your questions. He won't deal with all the doubts. He'll just say, David, I'm God. I'm God. And I know what I'm doing. Now get back into the front line. Face the jungle. Face the cavalry. But you go right on speaking for me. Let us pray. Oh God, how we thank you for the honesty of your word. How we thank you for revealing the inside as well as the outside of the ministry of your servant Jeremiah. How we thank you for disclosing to us those private moments your own son had when in the agony of his doubt, in the agony of his human shrinking from the cup that you wanted him to drink, he prayed so honestly. And Lord, that gives us hope. We come to you now. We present to the world and even to each other a bold face. We don't always share our doubts and agonies and burdens with each other. Maybe we should a little more. But Lord, we do share them with you. Lord, if there's someone here this morning who's struggling with an idol that has taken away their love for you and just taken first place, Lord, help them to share that burden with you through Jesus Christ our Lord.